Oh, great. Bringing state affairs to order at 3:06 p.m. Moving backwards in terms of punctuality, but we'll recover next time. It's Tuesday, February 15, 2022. We're in the Max Gruber Room, the Capitol, and we have all seven members present from my left to my right. Representative Kaufman, who's making his way with coffee. Representative Vance, Representative Tarr, myself, Chairface Tompkins. Representative Eastman, Representative Storing, Representative Klayman. The seven members, we have a quorum, and we will conduct some business today. In particular, we're going to move three bills out of this committee, barring some unexpected circumstance. Before we get to the three items in today's agenda, a couple of housekeeping and deadline-related notes. An amendment deadline for Rep. Uhl's HB 37, relating to income tax and the PERM fund, is tomorrow at 5 p.m. And to be clear, 5 p.m. means 5 p.m. It does not mean 5:01. It does not mean 5:02. In addition, for additional clarity, if anybody submits an amendment to legislative legal after 7 p.m. this evening, and there would need to be a time-stamped email to prove as much, there, under no circumstance, will an amendment be accepted that the request was not made by 7 p.m. this evening for HB 37. So if you submit your amendment to legislative legal for drafting, it's 7:02, and they don't get it to you in a timely fashion, it doesn't matter. We will not consider it, period. So just because you get your amendment in to legal before the deadline, but you're doing it a couple hours before the deadline, and like, oh, I'm so sorry, legislative legal was dragging their feet, I can't get it in a timely fashion, that will not work. So we're going to start having amendment submission deadlines to legislative legal just because there is a reasonable X factor in terms of their workload. I want to recognize that. And I know that's a bit of a sort of short advance on HB 37, and going forward, I think we'll have a more liberal submission deadline, and we're going to talk with legislative legal about what reasonable turnaround for them is, so they're not under the gun, you know, trying to scramble and turn amendments around at the 11th hour. So we'll get a more dialed process going forward, but for HB 37, please have any amendments that you wish to submit there by into legal by 7 p.m. this evening, and ideally the finished amendment to us by 5 p.m. tomorrow. As mentioned last week, we're going to be working on CS and working with the bill sponsor on HB 142, PFD eligibility. So more to come in due time. And that takes us to the three items in today's agenda, all of which have been considered previously. HB 158 from Representative Prox, and the two campaign contribution limit pieces of legislation from Representatives Justice and Ostrogi. So for HB 158, that's the third hearing, the second this year. I'd like to open just right out of the gate with public testimony, as though that was noticed today. So this time I'm going to open public testimony. I don't believe I see anybody in the room to testify on HB 158, but there is at least one individual online. Mr. Ed Martin, if you can hear us and are here to testify on HB 158, you are most welcome to, and please present your testimony in two or fewer minutes. The floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Chairman Tompkins, and other members of this committee. Some of you know me, probably some of you heard me before. I would hope so, because I'm a 56-year resident of the state of Alaska, five generations. The permanent fund dividend and its use has been a resounding success for our state over the years. And in it, it's been given the liberty through efforts of the state to make it available to charities through pick, click, and give. I have no qualms with that whatsoever. I do have a qualm with how it's being treated by the appropriation of those funds to the permanent fund dividends, yet that's not the subject here today. I'm very pleased to see that there's many of you in committee and or other sponsors in the House and probably the Senate to do something to make this so that we great citizens of Alaska can actually support our government. What's a little bit strange to me is that I'm a little worried if this isn't just one more avenue down the digital currency movement across the world, the Great Reset, and how they control people's money. I don't think you folks put any thought into this whatsoever, but that's all right. I'm bringing it out in testimony, and maybe it'll give you food for thought. As far as what, and one thing I see in this bill, in the sponsor statement, is that if you have other click, pick, and give options, that this would be on the bottom of the list. That's a little troublesome to me. It may not be the priority of some people. I do know this, that there's one fine gentleman up in Fairbanks that has been given his check, and I don't know how he's been doing it, for years, and he's testified in committees about that. And I think he's in more support of some of that permanent fund dividend being used for government routinely. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to necessarily say I'm negative against this. I am in support of anybody who wants to give government their money back, which I believe still belongs to us. But if they choose to change their mind upon getting it, or if it saves money for the state of Alaska, which it appears to me the fiscal note here is $4,260,000 to administer this.
And Mr. Martin, you're at this point in some excess of the 2 minutes. Could you summarize your comments?
Yes, thank you very much, Chair. I don't know if anybody else is waiting to testify. I would hope I get a little more liberty, but that's okay. Sum it up. You've got a fiscal note here to take money from the people that's really theirs. Now, I question that. Maybe you should too. Thank you very much, Chair, and members of the committee.
Thanks, Mr. Martin. I see no one else online to testify, which means we can consider amendments on HB 158. And there was one amendment submitted by the amendment deadline on HB 158 from Representative Eastman. I believe all members have that amendment. It's drafting number A.1. Representative Eastman.
Thank you. I move amendment number one.
Object.
There's an objection, Representative Eastman.
Thank you. I appreciate the objection so we can talk about this. So currently we have various options for Alaska residents to take money from the state in the form of their dividend and send it to some other entity, whether that's a charitable organization or whatnot. And I think that there's an argument for the state charging a 7% processing fee when the money is changing hands and going to Goodwill or whoever it goes to. I think there's less of an argument when the money actually isn't moving and it's kept in the possession of the state the whole time and someone is designating on their application that they don't want their dividend or portion of their dividend, they want that to stay in the state's hands. This would remove the fee for those transactions that aren't actually transactions. If the money is staying completely in the state's coffers and it's not going to any other outside entity, then there wouldn't be a 7% fee attached to that.
Thank you. Any questions or comments on Amendment 8.1, Amendment Number 1 from Representative Eastman? Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Who would we have as a potential question answerer?
A great question. Two potential question answerers are available online. Ms. Corey Bigelow from the Perm Fund Division Operations Manager, as well as Emily Nauman, but probably Ms. Bigelow, this particular amendment is it in question.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Bigelow, I guess, yeah, I would just like to get a response to that because, of course, as I understand it, that fee would be necessary because it's, you know, to represent the administrative, need and burden that would burden used lightly, but that would be created by this. So that mechanism would be there. So is that how I should understand it?
For the record, this is Corey Bigelow, PFD Operations Manager. Through the chair, Representative Tarr, to answer your question, yes, there would potentially be some sort of administrative costs associated with working with an Alaskan who would potentially be electing to contribute their dividend to the general fund, there would be some sort of processing at some level, but it would be a normal, they would be generally normal steps that our staff would take in determining eligibility or working a case of an applicant. And so I don't know if I could give you a monetary value specifically associated with doing those specific tasks. I'm sorry if that doesn't quite answer your question.
Through the chair, I just want to apologize, Mr. Bigelow. I apologize. I wasn't recalling, and so I just wanted to say sorry about that. And that's fine. I guess it's just that, you know, if we were to adopt this amendment, you know, you'd either need to be in a position where any additional workload could be absorbed by the existing staff, or, you know, we would be creating an unfunded mandate kind of situation. So I guess I'm just weary without having, you know, better understanding of the internal capacity, you know, among available staff. This would be a new responsibility. I don't know how much to imagine, but yeah, I guess it's not the dollar amount so much just as the sort of overall idea around, you know, needing someone to have this be part of their job description.
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Tarr. Yes, I do believe that PFD is expecting that that the workload could be handled by current staff, but that doesn't take into account the number of individuals that could potentially elect to contribute to the general fund. Obviously, if it is a lesser amount, I do believe that PFD could incorporate those tasks with current staff. At some point down the road, or if there were a large number of individuals that did choose to elect to give their dividend to the general fund, there could potentially be higher, you know, administrative costs involved for PFD. But without knowing how many individuals would potentially be contributing, we wouldn't be able to give you a definitive number on that.
And just last, very briefly, yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the latitude on these three questions. Then do you have a position for this amendment, support or oppose or indifferent?
Through the chair, Representative Tarr, I guess PFD is neutral in its stance on this bill. Depending on whether the legislature would decide whether there would be a 7% fee or not, that would be your decision, and we would follow whatever decision you make.
Thank you.
Representative Story.
Thank you. That was my same question.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. And a question for the sponsor.
Representative Prox.
And through the chair, I'm just curious if the sponsor has any information for us on how many people have availed themselves of this option currently. I know it's not available through Pick, Click, Give, but there is a way to, you know, give your money back to the state. And I'm just wondering if we know any of the numbers. Is that a large number of people? Is it a small number?
Yeah, there's, as far as I know, last year there were 105 people that returned their check to the state, and that does require some extra processing. You have to open the envelope and go to the bank and all those kind of things. This would eliminate those extra steps.
Great, thank you.
Representative Clayman.
Question for the Permanent Fund Division Representative. As I understand it today, if I give $100 to the food bank through Pick, Click, Give, there's a 7% processing fee so that the food bank receives $93 and $7 is paid to processing.
Through the chair, sorry, was that a question? I apologize.
It's a question. I want to make sure my understanding of the 7%, the current 7% is accurate. If I give $100 to the food bank on Pick, Click, Give, the food bank receives $93 and $7 goes to the permanent fund division to pay the administration costs, or does the $7 go somewhere else?
Thank you for that question. Through the chair, Representative Klayman, when an applicant donates $100 of their PFD, that $100 is provided to the Alaska Community Foundation, which is the organization that administers the program, and of that $100, they do receive 7% of it, so $7. Yes.
Follow up?
Yeah, follow up. So the 7% is actually coming out of the $100 coming from the dividend fund, effectively.
Through the chair, Representative Klayman, yes, that is correct. It is part of the overall amount that is contributed.
And follow up. As I read the proposed amendment, in this scenario, if somebody gave $100 back to the general fund, to the extent there were administrative costs, this amendment would require that that money come from somewhere else, because the full $100 would have to go entirely to the general fund, and any administrative costs related to it, whether they exist or didn't exist, would have to get funded from somewhere else. Have I got that right?
Through the chair, Representative Klayman, yes, that is my understanding of the reading as well.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just trying to read through the legal languages of this as well, but based upon the previous conversation, it sounds like the administrative costs are not, the permanent fund is not getting that 7%. The division is not getting the 7%. It's the other entity.
The Community Foundation.
The Community Foundation. What this amendment does, in my mind, from a business perspective, it encourages more people who may be inclined of, I don't need my dividend necessarily. What do I want to do with it? I support the money going to state services, that it would encourage that rather than discouraged by having a fee of 7%. So, because from the state's perspective, it's still a net gain. And the 7%, if that's a very round number, which based upon Representative Tarr's questions, he didn't have a specific dollar amount. That's essentially a cost of doing business in order to make the other possible $93 that would still go to the general fund. So to me, this makes sense from a business perspective, that's encouraging more people that if they want the dividend to go back to state services, that this is a way to do that without having to pay for it. It's just that simple click that isn't a change of hands. And I think that if we want to allow people that option, this may be the way to go.
I'm going to consider that a segue into closing comments on amendment number one. Are there other closing comments on amendment number one, Representative Klayman?
I'll just note again, I don't support the amendment. I think that the testimony is, well, this might not cost administratively much for us to do. We may be able to absorb it, but they don't really know because they don't know how many people are going to be involved in doing it. And so right now the amendment would essentially prohibit that cost to be recovered from the money that was contributed. But I still, this is part of the fundamental problem with this bill. It's not free money. To exercise this privilege, you pay 20% tax to the federal government, so you can give $100 so that the person that thinks, oh, I'm helping the government, they're paying for every $100, they're paying $20 to do that. And I just think I think if we're serious about trying to get money for the general fund, this is a terrible way to do it. I don't support the bill. I don't support the amendment.
Any other closing comments on amendment number one? Seeing none, Representative Eastman?
Thank you. And I do appreciate the back and forth we've had. And I also want to point out for the committee's benefit that all administrative costs incurred pursuant to distributing dividends, whether they're going to go to the state or anyone else, when we appropriate money to the dividend fund, that's part of that. So the money for processing, PFD applications, all that is coming from the dividend fund. and money to process fund applications that aren't going to go anywhere. I mean, to whatever extent there's a cost there, I mean, that is why we have the division. That's why we give them money from the permanent fund dividend program to do that. So this amendment, again, is offered because the Community Foundation is, you know, really isn't giving the money to anyone. So to sort of, you know, tax these kind of transactions at 7% seems unnecessary. Thank you.
And Representative Clayman, I assume you maintain your objection?
I do.
Will the clerk please call the roll on Amendment Number 1?
Representative Clark?
No.
Representative Story?
No.
Representative Clayman?
No.
Representative Vance?
Yes.
Representative
Coffman? Yes.
Yes.
No. And with 5 votes of 4 yeas, 3 4 nays, 3 yeas, Amendment Number 1 fails, which takes us back to the bill as a whole, unamended. Are there any closing questions on HB 158 before we go to closing comments? Seeing none, are there closing comments on HB 158? Seeing none, a motion, Representative Clayman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move to report House Bill 158, version 32, LS 0746-A, out of committee with individual recommendations in the accompanying fiscal note.
Seeing and hearing no objection, House Bill 158 moves from committee. Thank you, Representative Prox, for being available, and we'll circulate the paperwork as we continue with the next item on today's agenda, which is HB 245. And for HB 245, Representative Josephson is not available to be with us today. I believe Finance Subcommittee duties may be commanding his time, but we do have Mr. Cohn to represent Representative Josephson. And this is the third hearing on this bill and perhaps the final hearing on this bill. We have 3 amendments that were submitted on HB 245. Before we get to those amendments, Mr. Cohn, any opening comments that you'd like the committee to consider before we dive into amendments? Okay. That takes us to amendments. We'll first take up Amendment Number 1, A.2, Representative Eastman.
Thank you. I'll move Amendment 1.
Object.
There's an objection, Representative Eastman.
Thank you. The amendment would remove the aggregate limit on campaign contributions, and we've heard in previous testimony about how the courts feel about aggregate limits and not being able to make a meaningful distinction between a donation that comes in at 11:50 p.m. versus one that comes in at 11:55, and just because, you know, someone is in one state or another state or any of the other ways these aggregate limits are calculated, the court isn't able to justify that limit on the free speech of the individuals trying to make those donations. So this would remove the aggregate language, and it would let, you know, everything else in the bill stay as is.
And before we take up any questions or comments on Amendment Number 1, I just might add, welcome Representative Josephson, my comments that sort of the broader intent here is for the committee to consider both pieces of legislation, potentially move both pieces of legislation and sort of allow them to live or die by Darwinian process in rules and whatever bill might be able to muster support in order to advance to a floor vote can do so. I imagine only one of these 2 bills will be successful in doing that. Maybe that will be a segue to my comment on Amendment Number 1 from Representative Eastman. I think there are really valid points being highlighted, although I think my personal perspective would be to sort of honor the intent of the sponsor and his sort of differentiated approach from the other piece of legislation we'll be considering today. So with all that context, any further questions on Amendment Number 1 from Representative Eastman, Representative Clayman?
Just for clarity, the aggregate limits are aggregate out-of-state limits is what we're talking about?
Mm-hmm. And Representative Eastman nods in the affirmative. Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I just want to say on this legislation today, I want to make comments in committee specifically because it's possible the action we take could be challenged again. And so I just want to make sure that I comment so it's part of the record. I will be opposing this amendment because even the 50% feels like a stretch. You know, I know we're constrained by the court decision and trying to thread the needle of, you know, setting new limits based on their decision, but I'm even very, very concerned and, you know, if I had the choice, you know, that 50% would be a much lower number. And so, you know, I just want to make sure that I express that opposition and support for a lower number. And, you know, I have tried to understand the reasonings and, you know, in the court decision, but I think, you know, Alaska has some very unique circumstances with small population, low cost media market, that we could be quickly overwhelmed by outside dollars. And we could also become kind of a test case state, which we've previously been, you know, for ballot initiatives on, you know, the whole political spectrum, because those same outside moneyed influences look to Alaska as a, you know, an easy state to organize in, an easy state to have a dollar stretch in. And so, again, even the 50% feels, you know, like a high number that we have the potential to let a lot of outside influence into our, you know, political decision-making process. So I'll be opposing the amendment.
Representative Clemen.
I recognize that it's probably not all that common that I agree with amendments offered by the representative from Wasilla, but this is one in which I agree with him. I think that the court is has been pretty articulate that the out-of-state limits are unconstitutional. That was decided actually several years ago. They have been unenforceable for a period of years. There's no reason we should have it on the statute when they're not constitutional. So I'm going to remove my objection for amendment number one.
I'll object.
And there's an objection from Representative Tarr. Any further questions? Representative Vance.
Sorry, I raised my hand, but I do have a comment when you're ready.
Okay. Well, seeing no further questions on amendment number one. Actually, I'll ask Representative Josephson, is it fair to assume you were opposed to amendment number one?
Yes. And the court didn't take up out-of-state limits for groups, which this set of repealers would do.
That is noted. Seeing no further questions, we'll move to comments. Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is one that, you know, I think a lot of us have personal feelings on, that we would like things to be a certain way. But when I look at the principle of what we're being asked to consider here in light of the court's opinions, one thing that Alaskans have asked of us is to require transparency in whatever it is that we do as candidates, as politically appointed people on any level of government. They want to know exactly what's going on and who is contributing and being influential in the lives of decision makers. And when we look at the outside contribution limits, we know that that's happening in one form or another. And I think if I fall back on the principle that all political power is inherent in the will of the people, and they can see who the contributors are, whether they're outside influence or they're within the state, that they ultimately get to decide, because one district may tolerate a certain level of outside contribution more than another. And I think that should be weighed here. So even though I don't like it, I don't prefer a lot of outside money being influenced in our elections, I think the principle of it is that the people should determine that. And so I will be supporting this amendment today.
Seeing no further comments, Representative Eastman.
Thank you. And, yeah, appreciate the comments. So I personally would love to see outside influence, you know, done away with, if for no other reason than, you know, it dilutes my ability to have a larger voice in my community. And having that voice in my community right now is more important to me than having a voice in some other community somewhere, which might have value, but not as important as you know, what's in my backyard. And it's good to get that, you know, on the record. But Unfortunately, I think what the court would say is if that's our purpose, or one of our purposes is reducing that, you know, outside influence, then that is not an acceptable infringement on the First Amendment. Because again, the situation we're talking about is you have, you know, two contributions to a campaign. One, let's just say, a legislator's family members that live out of state. So you have a brother and a sister or a parent, you know, out of state, and the brother gets his campaign, you know, contribution in first, which is acceptable. But then the sister tries to get a contribution in and it's not acceptable because now we're in the above that aggregate limit or whatnot. And the court says the brother and the sister both have equal First Amendment rights to be able to cast a vote, if you will, through campaign donations and exercise their First Amendment rights accordingly. So the amendment here is just, it's recognizing that and saying that that's, I don't think that there's a way to thread that needle to limit that outside influence in a way that doesn't unduly impinge on the First Amendment.
Representative Tarr, your objection is maintained, I assume. All right. Will the clerk please read the roll or call the roll for amendment number one?
Yes.
Representative Tarr.
No.
Representative Story.
No.
Representative Plainman.
Yes.
Representative Mann.
Yes.
Representative Hoffman.
Yes.
Chair Pickham.
No.
Four yeas, three nays.
And by a vote of four yeas, three nays, amendment number one, 8.2, passes. Takes us to amendment number two, 8.3, Representative Eastman.
Thank you. I will move amendment number two.
There's an objection, Representative Eastman.
Thank you. And this is going to deal with one of the topics that came up in our previous hearing, and that is how are we going to inflation adjust these campaign limits? And it's my contention that the idea of doing this every 5 years is problematic, if for no other reason than it's an odd number of years. And so every other election, you're going to have this adjustment, you know, taking place sort of midway through that election. And in order to minimize that that confusion and also make that adjustment happen more frequently and therefore hopefully be more accurate to the value of that campaign contribution at any point in time, we're going to have it not be a five-year period. This will just be every year. And then the adjustment will take effect May 1st of each year, which hopefully would be before, say, June 1st, when you know, there's a candidate filing deadline.
Any questions for Representative Eastman on amendment number two? Representative Clayman.
This is on A4, right?
A.3.
Mr. Chairman.
I don't have a copy of A.3.
I don't have A.3 either.
Brief at ease.
I thought maybe it was just me.
Okay, back on the record. I think we all have amendment number 2, A.3. And let's see, where were we? I think the last question was, what is amendment number 2, A.3? Are there any questions for amendment number 2, A.3? Representative Clayman.
I would move an amendment to amendment number 2, which is A.3. The purpose of the amendment would be to make it so that these calculations occur every 2 years rather than every year. And the reason is that we actually, setting aside the complexity of Anchorage municipal elections, which are sort of on a different calendar, but at some point I can't solve all the problems. The intent would be that we'd be on a 2-year cycle so that the actual fundraising cycle for campaigns would not have an amount change during that 2-year period or the 18-month period in which there is campaign fundraising that's allowed. So the amendment would be on line 2 of amendment number 2, change where it says every 5 years, that would now read every 2 years thereafter. And I think it would then line 4 of the amendment would be deleted because it would be done every 2 years. And then on page 7 and 8, or line 7 and 8 of the amendment, it would change, instead of delete 5-year period, it would now insert would be 2-year periods.
And I would support that amendment.
Is there any objection to conceptual amendment number 1 to amendment number 2A.3?
A clarification?
I'll object for purposes of discussion. Representative Story, a clarification.
Yes. So on line 2, you're saying insert beginning in the first quarter every 2 years. Is that correct?
Yes, correct.
Okay. Thank you. And then I do have a question.
Representative Story.
I'm wondering what the sponsor of the bill thinks of this amendment.
Mr. Cohn.
Through the chair, Max Cohn, staff to Representative Josephson. I can speak at least to the sponsor's opinion on 1 year indexing, because he just left before the amendment to the amendment. And it's his opinion that that would be excessive every year to index. I imagine he might feel the same about 2 years, and that might be an undue burden on the commission, but I couldn't say for sure.
Thank you.
Seeing no further questions.
The only thing I note in terms of the conceptual amendment is there may actually need to be some adjustment on line 11 of the amendment where it says the adjustment takes effect May 1st of each year. I think it might need to say something along the lines of the adjustment takes effect May 1st of each of the applicable year. Again, I'm not trying to take the place of whatever Ledge Legal does for conformity, but I think that would also need to be adjusted in the conceptual amendment to reflect that the adjustment only happens on May 1st of the year that it is in effect.
I think that's a good point. I support that.
Noted. And I think for the purposes of any conceptual amendments adopted by the committee, the legislative legal has the ability to make any conforming changes that they might desire. Representative Vance.
Do we have APOC online to talk to the impacts of what this might, what the process would be to be able to make this adjustment every 2 years? I'm assuming it would be APOC that would be making this, just so that we have a further clarification of the difference between doing this every 5 years versus 2 years.
Yes, we do. Tom Lucas is online. Mr. Lucas, do you or APOC have a perspective on that question? Or Ms. Hebden, forgive me. I see Ms. Hebden is also online, the ED of APOC. Ms. Hebden?
Through the chair, obviously the more we do it, the more of a burden it would be. Every 2 years would be more in line with what we consider the 18-month cycle. 18 months is when a candidate can officially file a letter of intent and begin collecting contributions. Given that a candidate can still collect contributions for 45 days after an election, it seems like 2 years would still, it seems probable that he would still be operating under two contribution limits during one campaign cycle. Not to say that that couldn't happen, it just seems like it would be more difficult to police.
I think that's all the questions I have right now. Thank you.
Are there additional questions for Amendment Number 1, Conceptual Amendment Number 1 to Amendment Number 2? Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's not a question, but I just want to make a brief comment just because this keeps coming up sort of about these CPI adjustments and just using the minimum wage as an example, you know, because we raised it 2016, it was 975, then it went 980, 984, 989, 1019, 1034, 1034. So, you know, there, if we're leaving the language in that says to the nearest $50 increment, I mean, just looking over this last, 8-year period, It seems that, you know, you don't need to do it quite that often. If you give a $50 kind of window for that adjustment, that, you know, it's gonna be enough to cover itself over a multi-year period. So I guess I would be leaning towards just leaving it the way it is, just because I think it's difficult to communicate these kind of things to the public and to have much change, and then it probably wouldn't, just because if you're going to round to the nearest $50 increment anyhow.
Representative Eastman.
Thanks. And I think the hope is that it doesn't change and it stays the same, which case the commission would evaluate it and would discover that it hasn't changed. And so there would be no need to, you know, propose a regulation to change it. But I also think that the future is not always easily predicted, and it very well may be the case where it does change. And certainly if it does change, we should be prepared to anticipate that in our statute and allow the commission to adjust that accordingly.
Additional questions on amendment number one to amendment number two? Representative Tarr, I'm trying to, is my objection, and I think I will remove my objection. Is there additional objection to conceptual amendment number one? Representative Story's objection. Will the clerk please call the roll on conceptual amendment number one to amendment number two?
Yes.
Representative Easton.
Yes.
Representative
Hart. No.
Representative
Story. No. Representative
Story. Yes.
Representative Clement. Yes. Representative Vance. Yes. By vote of 5 yeas, 2 nays, conceptual amendment number 1 to amendment number 2, 8.3. passes, and just to reiterate that Legislative Lingle has the latitude to make all necessary conforming changes to that conceptual amendment. That takes us back to amendment number two as amended. And I don't believe there were any questions, so we'll go to wrap up. Any comments on amendment number two, A.3? And then wrap up, Representative Eastman.
Thank you. I appreciate the exchange of ideas. I think the amendment is the better for it. And to be clear, since it's not in front of you, instead of having a change every year, it will now take place once every 2 years. And that is being done, and I think that's an improvement.
Let's see. And for amendment number two, Representative Tarr, I believe you may have leveled the objection.
I'm maintaining my objection.
Okay. With the objection maintained, will the clerk please call the roll on amendment number two as amended?
Representative Vance.
Yes.
Representative
Kaufman.
Yes.
Representative Eastman.
Yes.
Representative Hart.
No.
Representative Story.
No.
Yes.
Yes.
5 yeas, 2 nays.
By a vote of 5 yeas and 2 nays, amendment number 2 as amended, A.3, passes. That takes us to amendment number 3, A.4, Representative Eastman.
Thank you. I'll move amendment number 3, which is A.4.
I'll object for discussion.
There's an objection from Representative Tarr, Representative Eastman.
Thank you. And on page 2, line 22, we have beginning in the first quarter of calendar year 2023. This amendment would change that to 2024. And then instead of having the effective date be immediate, it would delay the effective date until the first day of next year. And the thought process was, instead of it going into effect immediately during a campaign year, where we would then inevitably have changes on one side, campaign limits being one thing before the bill passes and then being another after it passes, this would help to ameliorate that by delaying the effective date until after the election year has concluded.
Are there questions for the sponsor amendment number three, Representative Tarr?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Not so much for the sponsor, but for APOC, because my understanding is absent legislation, there's this sort of gray area, $1,500, for example, individual contribution limit, but I'd like their response to the characterization that, you know, if we change the effective date, that the ambiguity is removed from this current election cycle.
Ms. Hebden?
For the chair, Representative Tarr, could you rephrase that question? I'm not sure I followed that.
So, as I understand it, the court decision came out, and then in response to that, and through the chair, the APOC made adjustments, and so we currently have this $1,500 limit that came into place, but that was already an adjustment made during an election cycle. And so I'm just trying to understand what Representative Eastman has suggested with this amendment is that if the effective date is pushed out by 1 year, then there wouldn't be uncertainty in this election cycle. But I guess that's not how it's been described to me. And so I'm not sure if I'm misunderstanding the situation. Absent legislation, is it going to for sure stay $1,500? So how any changes, you know, how does the effective date impact what you're doing?
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Tarr, I'm not sure that changing the effective date would, I mean, I would agree with your statement. I don't think it would alleviate any of the ambiguity that currently exists. Currently, the staff has made a recommendation for our commission, but it's yet to be considered by the commission. So at this point, it is simply informal guidance that has been proposed by staff, but there has been no final decision made. Ultimately, it should be a legislative fix, though, as far as contributions go.
Thank you.
Other questions on amendment number three, Representative Klayman?
First, I want to move an amendment to amendment one to amendment number three, and that would be to delete lines 1, 2, and 3 of amendment number three, because with all due respect, I know the representative from Wasilla sometimes doesn't have his amendments passed, but the amendment that's in line 1, 2, and 3 is actually inconsistent with what we just have in amendment number two, which would start the inflation adjusting in 2023. And I think making the amendment as proposed in amendment number three to now change 2023 to 2024 is actually inconsistent with what we did in the last amendment. So I move amendment number one to amendment number three, which would delete the first three lines.
Representative Eastman?
And I will not object.
Is there any further objection to amendment number one to amendment number three? Hearing none, conceptual amendment number one to amendment number three passes, which takes us back to amendment number three as conceptually amended.
And so my comment on this is that I believe amendment number three, as amended, would mean that for the duration of the 2022 election cycle, there would be only the, at best, advisory limits or whatever limits that APOC as a commission may adopt. But there would be no limits in law unless the bill is effective immediately. And so for those reasons, I don't support amendment number three as amended.
Further comments on amendment number three or questions? Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do we have legal on? I would like to ask them the impact if we were to pass this amendment with the 2023 effective date and the APOC advisory decision of a $1,500 limit was the only thing that was currently out there for the remainder of this election cycle. What authority does APOC have to sustain that and enforce it on candidates? And what would be the impact if it were litigated?
Mr. Bullard, if you're online, did you track those questions from Representative Vance?
Good afternoon to the chair, members of the committee. For my edification, if Representative Vance would be so good as to repeat her question, I would appreciate it.
Thank you. I think I've previously asked for a legal memo on this decision, and I would be okay if you were to share that with the thoughts about the impact of this decision with the committee for the legislative record. But my question was, if this amendment number 3 were to pass with the effective date of 2023, what authority does APOC have to with their decision of a $1,500 limit, and can they enforce it on candidates in this legislative cycle? That would be the first question.
Members of the committee and Chair Christ Tompkins, this is Alpheus of Ledge Legal, for the record. You know, it's difficult to say exact. Much will depend on whether the commission adopts its informal opinion, clarifying how the limits should be applied at this time. It is not certain that they will. But what is certain is that this bill won't be effective before whatever effective date is provided for it. And so if APOC were not to accept its draft opinion, it's possible that APOC would determine that it's up to the legislature because they're in session to make that choice. And right now this bill would not take effect before the effective date that's provided for it.
Follow up. Would the can APOC enforce the $1,500 preliminary limit that they have proposed?
Representative Vant, through the chair, APOC has the statutory authority to implement and clarify the provisions of the chapter. This is Chapter 1513, which is our campaign finance statute. And I think that's more than a slender read. If APOC does indeed decide that that is the appropriate action for the commission to take, the legislature certainly could change the effective date of any legislation relating to campaign finance or pass a bill if it is unhappy with the commission's decision. And APOC's interpretation would likely survive until that time.
All right, thank you.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you, and I'll follow up through the chair for Mr. Bullard. Now, the authority that we have granted to the commission to clarify, what is legal and what is not legal, is that broad enough if they felt very strongly that the limitations in statute were not the right limits? Do they have the authority to clarify that those limits should be increased or decreased in any way?
Representative Eastman, through the chair, I mean, a court will be the arbiter of that decision. And the rest of us find out, but the legislature in its wisdom did provide the commission the authority to implement and clarify the provisions. If an individual was unsatisfied with the way that the commission implemented or clarified the provisions, they could certainly challenge the commission's actions. Then we would find out.
Follow up. I'll put that in the category of a non-answer, but I appreciate your dancing around, so to speak. What constraints has the legislature placed on the ability of the commission to clarify what we as a legislature have put into statute in which they are to enforce?
Representative Eastman through the chair, I don't think the legislature has put any limits on the commission in statute in terms of what they can do in clarifying the statutes, but if the commission takes some action that's you know, outside of implementing or clarifying the statutes, and that would be beyond their authority. And so much will determine on whether they are implementing and clarifying, you know, these provisions that are enacted both by the legislature and the people of the state through their initiative power.
Thank you.
Representative Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair, and this may require participation of APOC and Ledge Legal, I'm not sure. But as I'm thinking through all this, I'm trying to make sure in my head that we're not somehow creating a compliance trap, and that the dates are synchronized, and we talked about that a little bit. So you have amounts. So if someone has received an amount in excess of what the new amount is, and then we go into effect, what kind of how do we reconcile that? So is that where people are, like, immediately upon it, this bill going into effect, are we in a state of jeopardy that we're in noncompliance because of something that happened before? So what is the correction? Should someone have gotten a contribution, a couple hundred bucks in excess of what is now legal, and it goes into effect legally, are we in a loop that's going to be a mess to undo? And I'm not sure who to address that to, but it's a question in my mind right now. Thank you.
Representative Kaufman, do you have a preference to whom that question is addressed, or is that a comment?
Well, I think we could start with, I'd be interested in input from both APOC maybe to start with, and then Ledge Legal.
Ms. Hepton?
For the chair, Representative Hoffman, with the current status, with a draft advisory opinion out there recommending the $1,500 contribution limit under our statute, a complaint cannot be filed against someone that follows that guidance. That could change should the commission reject staff's recommended advisory opinion, and at that point, I can't say for certain what would happen if legislation passed that conflicted with the guidance that candidates are operating under right now. I don't think as a matter of policy it would be something that the agency would pursue given the state of affairs right now.
And Mr. Bullard, I think same question at Representative Kaufman's request.
Representative Kaufman, through the chair, I would align myself with the comments of APOC. And anybody who is acting in good faith pursuant to APOC's recommended limit or a statutory limit, I don't think it's going to be held to account for following that guidance.
Follow up. Yes, to that last comment, so, but it doesn't sound very reassuring as someone who might be on the firing line for that. It sounds to me like a better course would be to make sure that all of the amounts and the dates are such that we cannot fall into that state of jeopardy rather than hope for, let's call it a pass in the future. But would you agree?
Representative Kaufman, through the chair, I think that insofar as there is uncertainty right now as to what the contribution limit, the faster the legislature clarifies what that limit is, the sooner these issues will be dispensed with.
Ms. Hebden, do you have any comment on... More of a comment in the form of a question from Representative Kaufman, but nonetheless, you're welcome to chime in.
Thank you, Chair Price Tompkins. I would concur with Mr. Bullard. The faster the issue is resolved, the better everybody will be.
Any other questions on Amendment Number 3? Seeing none, Representative Tarr, is the objection maintained? Okay, that takes Amendment Number 3. As amended back before us, and a final comment from the sponsor, Representative Eastman, then we'll go to a vote.
Yes, and to retrace the chronology briefly, the court declared that it was quite certain that the limit that we currently have in our statute is not kosher according to the Constitution. And so AIPOC has responded that since the court has made it clear that it's not constitutional, they will not be enforcing that statute. And so they have, their staff has recommended that the commission adopt a $1,500 limit to be enforced. In my view, I think the staff's trying to help a little bit too much. And instead of trying to decide what limit they're going to enforce or not enforce, they should have given a recommendation to the legislature on what the legislature should decide should be enforced or not enforced. And I think we're trying to do that through this bill. I would like to see that there's as little confusion as possible on donations which have made to this point in the campaign versus donations made after a bill passes, assuming a bill does pass. Because right now, without this limit, you know, we're guaranteed that the limits are going to change for at least the state Senate and at least the state House candidates. You're going to have, you know, donors that donated at one part of the year are going to get, you know, treated separately by AIPOC because they're not going to enforce, you know, against a $1,500 donation. But they will for later donations in the same year for the same elections for those state House and Senate races. So that's a concern. But I recognize that there are different ways that people can see this. So I will withdraw the amendment now and look for a better solution.
With that, amendment number 3, as conceptually amended, is withdrawn. That takes us back before the bill before us as amended. Are there final questions or comments?
Can we take a brief at ease?
Brief at ease. Going back on the record, just taking stock of the different moving pieces here with amendments passing and failing and being withdrawn and conceptual amendments and all that good stuff. Any questions for the bill sponsor now that we have the bill back before us as amended?
I mean, I guess
Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, from the bill sponsor's perspective, we haven't done anything on the graduated limits for individual races, so that's one area not addressed. But then we've made a significant change to the aggregate out-of-state contribution allowable amount, and then have made a significant, you know, change to the extent that you think it's significant in terms of the overall impact of the legislation to change from the every 5-year adjustment to the every 2 years. So I'm just wondering, has the bill been changed significantly enough that would cause the sponsor to be concerned with it moving forward?
Through the chair, Max Cohn, staff, Director Josephson, I believe the sponsor still believes that the graduated limits are not only more reflective of what he perceives to be the will of Alaskan voters, but also a more narrowly tailored tool to fighting corruption. In other court cases, courts have looked at how states justify their limits, and having a graduated limit is one way to show court, whatever court might take this up, that Alaska is interested in adjusting its limits to different races that raise different amounts of money for them. So I believe the sponsor still believes that the graduated limits are worth having.
Of course. Well, at this point, seeing no further questions for the sponsor, I'm going to turn to public testimony. And as has kind of been the case, given the sort of couplet of bills that the committee has been considering between Representative Justice and Representative Sharkey, I'm going to co-mingle public testimony for both pieces of legislation, given the effectively identical subject matter. And also allow for a little bit more time per testifier. That is 3 minutes. And with that, Actually, before I open public testimony, just as a housekeeping note, I'm going to close public testimony on HB 158. So that's that loop is closed. And we can open public testimony on the combination of HB 245 and HB 234. I don't believe I see anybody in the room to testify on the combination of HBs 245 and 234, but online, it looks like we have a number of people here to testify. And let's start with Randy Riedrich in Anchorage. If you can hear us, please go ahead and put yourself on record and present your testimony in three or fewer minutes.
Good afternoon. This is Randy Riedrich, R-E-N-D-Y, R-U-E-D-R-I-C-H, trustee of Denver.
Sorry, I missed that last comment or question, Mr. Riedrich.
My question was just to make sure that you could hear me.
I ironically didn't quite make out the question, but broadly speaking, we can hear you quite well.
Perfect. To save time, I'll simply address the matter in the following context. Since 245 is substantially more complete than 234, I will not spend any time on 234, which I consider to be further away from where we need to go, and I would encourage you not to confuse the process by keeping it. Secondly, dealing with 245, I think your progress on how to make annual adjustments was very heartening. I think the biannual adjustment is correct, and I would encourage you to look at a simple solution, which is to use the FEC as a guide. The FEC has been adjusting Senate races and U.S. House races since 1974, and we should be able to use that since it's worked for over 35 years. It should be a good model to use here in Alaska and save the commission the difficulty of doing something novel, unique, and different. Secondly, I am disturbed about the idea of 50% outside money. Let's talk about what the court struck down. In a million dollar Senate race, you had 2% outside money allowed because of the $20,000. In a $100,000 House race, you had $300,000 outside money allowed. The highest number I think that you should consider is an incredible increase from 2% to something like 25%. I'd actually like a lower number, but I'm sensitive to what I heard today. 50% is way too high. 25% is more realistic because we're going from 2% to 25%. And if you can find a way to ratchet it down a little further, I would think that's a great idea. Secondly, I largely agree with the graduated limits that were proposed for races, but let's add a mayor's race for Anchorage especially, and Anchorage Assembly and school board races, which are much more complex area-wide relevance than a state Senate race. So I think we have a good product. We just need to make it a little better. The other thing that disturbs me greatly is this is an incumbent protection piece of legislation. We're talking about annual limits rather than election limits. We should have campaign contribution limits per election, and that includes the Anchorage election runoff. So we would have primary elections, general elections, and runoff elections. So there's three ways to collect money. No one could collect three in their own right in a given filing, but there's different election significance here. So I believe that we need to modify this. Otherwise, we're giving a huge advantage to incumbents who know they're going to run, and someone who comes up to file in January has a 100% loss of that first year of campaign contributions. Let's fix that. That's always been wrong. It's still wrong. I thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Riedrich, for that testimony. Any questions from the committee? Seeing none. Moving next in the queue, Beverly Churchill, if you can hear us, welcome. Please go ahead and put yourself on record and present your testimony.
Yeah, thank you. This is Beverly Churchill. I am here as a member of the Alaska Move to Amend. I have been listening in on these hearings, and I applaud Representative Josephson and Shoggy for working so hard on crafting these bills, HB 245 and 234, respectively. I thank this committee for taking them up and engaging in meaningful discussion. Alaska Move to Amend has let legislators know our position and recommendation. But the bottom line is whatever you decide is imperative, our state maintains some limits on campaign expenditures. I personally think that the $750 is a great place to start, and Representative Josephson has a good rationale for it. I'm not so sure about the graduation as bigger races sweep in a larger base of voters and potential donors. And I think it maybe complicates the understanding for the voter. I also think it is vital to have the indexing adjustment. I was going to suggest every 4 years to match the election cycles. Well, I guess that doesn't really match election cycles. So maybe the 2 years is a little better. It does seem a little like I think maybe Representative Tarr mentioned, they're very incremental. So the 4 years would be at least a little more reasonable for the effort to put into it. But at any rate, I appreciate the dialogue intense thought you're putting into it. The voters of Alaska have entrusted you to make the best decision for our state, and this is a very vital one. I think, yes, it does need to go into effect as soon as possible. Things are kind of cloudy, and so this will help give us something to move forward in the state. I thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee for Ms. Churchill? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony. And next in the queue, and I hope I get the pronunciation more or less right, Charmin Haley in Anchorage. If you can hear us, please go ahead, put yourself on record, and present your testimony.
Yes, this is Charmin Haley, and I've also an activist with Alaska Move to Amend, and I've also been following your committee hearings. I will keep my remarks brief. You've all heard from me by email. I very much appreciate your taking up this issue in a very timely fashion. I underscore the comments by Hebden and Bullard that the sooner the legislature takes action, the better, because it clarifies, it minimizes the period of uncertainty. I will also make a brief comment on removing the aggregate limits, the question of outside contributions, understanding that whatever we do in this regard is likely to be challenged in court and may be found unconstitutional. I stand by a position that we should craft what we want to be our policy and law and take a stand on it and let the courts test it. And if it's unconstitutional, it won't get enforced. But as a matter of record, we should be stating exactly what we, the Alaska citizenry, want as our policy on this score and carry the fight on forward from that. And thank you very much for your very thoughtful deliberation on these issues. I think that the a remaining question is how we're going to get the legislation to pass through the Senate as well before the end of the session. And I appreciate your efforts. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for the committee, from the committee? Seeing none. And I see no one else online, but I actually want to exercise the prerogative of circling back to Mr. Riedrich. I have a belated question. Mr. Riedrich, if you're still with us, would you be able to restate the last question that you, or the last issue that you raised in your testimony about incumbent protection, and just sort of restate that consideration?
Well, very simply, I'm glad I stayed around. Thank you. Very simply, if we have an election process that is an annual contribution, if someone decides to file as a challenger and does so in the election year, he or she faces a primary and a general election. The incumbent, who had prior knowledge, and if I believe essentially every incumbent who intends to run filed, or at least in the high 90% of all the incumbents filed in the odd year, so they could raise some money before Christmas or before New Year, to be specific. I am very concerned about preventing challengers from having that opportunity, and the federal election campaign finance process is very simple. There is money that can be attributed to the primary. There's money attributed to the general election. It's not the year that's contributed. It's two separate campaign limits, one for primary and one for general. I would encourage us to adopt the very same concept of money for primary and money for general. And of course, no one could spend any of their primary money to try to get into the high four, because that would be a violation of campaign finance. So thinking about it, I'm just trying to encourage a fair opportunity for challengers to enter the process. That is what my comment is about. Any questions?
And to play that back, Mr. Riedrich, effectively you're advocating for a per campaign period approach as opposed to a per calendar period, calendar year period, just to be totally clear.
No.
Okay. Thank you.
Under federal law, it's not that the money has to be raised before the primary or before the general. It just cannot be spent more than primary money can only be spent for the primary. And in this case, if we allow for a runoff, then since Anchorage has a mayoral runoff, we're putting that race in a situation of being very complicated. Since if the donor contributed in the general election, they're facing a different electorate, a different world, just a matter of weeks later. That money would have to be raised as a separate tranche of funds to make the whole process less dependent on independent expenditures and to get the people into the process of funding campaigns rather than have independent expenditure groups funding campaigns.
Thank you. Representative Eastman, did you have a question?
Just was asking for clarification on money raised during the primary, you know, being used to get into the top four. And I what I heard you to say, Mr. Riedrich, a moment ago was that the federal limits are on expenditures, so you couldn't, you know, move money from a primary campaign and then to a general campaign to spend it. And is that what you were referring to when you said not using primary money to get into a top four?
No, it's exactly the opposite.
Oh, please restate for us.
My statement is correct. The interpretation is not what I meant to share with you. The primary dollars that are not spent in the primary can be spent in the general. But if you raise $25,000 for the primary, and you have to indicate that in your filing with APOC, just as federal races have to indicate with the FEC that they've got $25,000 in federal primary money and $26,000 in general funds, if you spent $30,000 in the primary, you have spent more money than you raised, and therefore you have a technical violation.
Very good. Thank you. That makes it much clearer.
I'm sorry?
Thank you. That was very clear. I appreciate that.
I didn't use an adequate example. I'm sorry.
I think Representative Kaufman may have a question.
Thank you. Through the chair to Mr. Rudrick. I guess I'm wondering, so we are at the closeout in your model of a primary campaign, and if I understand you correctly, and you didn't mention this, but I'm going to throw it in there. So you have whatever money that was in a future campaign account, which sometimes exists, is included, and that becomes part of what's being spent in the primary along with the money raised in the primary. So in your model, would you say that that money raised in the primary and contained in any rollover from a previous campaign would be fair game for spending in the primary?
Or fair game in the primary, and any of this leftover can be spent in the general.
Thank you.
All right. Seeing no further questions, thank you, Mr. Rudrick, for sticking around. I'm going to do a final scan. I know that there was Mr. Robert Welton, who was online at least recently. Mr. Welton, if you can hear us, please go ahead and put yourself on record and present your testimony.
Hello, my name is Robert Welton, and I wanted to testify for myself. I live in Douglas. I was raised to live by the rule that thou shalt not steal, and so was raised to be an honest citizen and a person. My dad taught me that our society and its leaders are also honest, so I feel the unrestricted flow of money into Alaska politics threatens the moral foundations of our society. I'm heartened that the committee is also taking this seriously. Alaskan voters have repeatedly voted to limit the role of money by big corporations, but the Supreme Court through Citizens United and also the Ninth Circuit threw out those limits, which we had voted to adopt. So I want to just speak out and just say that we need to reinstitute limits, that without new legislation, then everything's going to triple, which is counter to the wishes of the people. HB 234 and 245 attempt to do this in a way that passes challenge. So I personally prefer the simpler, lower limits in 234, but I think both look pretty good. My only concern, if I'm reading the bill right, with 234, is it seems to be exempting independent groups from any limits, if I'm reading it right. And I think that's a bad idea. I think that the legislature should find a lawful way to reinstitute limits rather than throw up the surrender flag to the federal courts on this matter. To conclude, I would just point out that Plutarch, Sallust, and Cicero each pointed to corruption as a core reason for the decline of the Roman Empire. So please enact one of these bills to maintain constraints on the money spigot pointed at Alaska, allowing billionaires to exert greater pressure on our democracy raises the risk of corruption and the moral decline that I see possible right here in Alaska. So finally, thanks for hearing me out and for your service to the state.
Thank you very much, Mr. Welton, for your testimony and taking the time. Any questions from the committee? Seeing none, and I just want to do a final scan, look to the back of the room. I don't think we have anybody else here to testify, so at this time I'm going to close testimony on the combined bills HB 245 and 234. Let's see here. So that takes us back to House Bill 245 as amended. Any closing comments on House Bill 245?
Brief Eddies?
Back on the record. Closing comments, House Bill 245, Representative Story.
Thank you, Chair. I have been thinking about this for a while, like everybody has, and just listening to testimony today and the discussion, which I appreciate. I think both bills, you know, are definitely set limits and are very responsive. I do feel that I prefer the graduated limits and the lower amounts. So I will be voting for this bill. But I also feel the other bill has good merits too, and I'm willing to move them both forward for the larger discussion in the building for more voices to weigh in. Thank you.
Representative Story. Other comments? Representative Eastman.
Thank you. I do want to applaud the sponsor for, I guess, to the best extent possible, trying to tailor the statute to reflect what the people voted that it should be. That was many years ago, and they voted for a $500 limit. So in keeping with what the courts have said needs to happen, I think the sponsor has done a good job of trying to go back to that point in time. I will say, though, my view is if the people were to vote on it today, I think they would probably not vote for a $500 limit. And so the terrain has changed so dramatically since the people had an opportunity to vote on it. I would see that in that earlier time, this was before Citizens United, there were strict limits on what, you know, independent expenditure groups could spend money on. Now, since they have the opportunity to spend as much as they want, the idea of going back to these limits on individuals really puts the individual at a huge disadvantage, and the candidate that individual would support is at a huge disadvantage. And so those who are more organized and entrenched, the political class, if you will, the professionals, who have the independent expenditures groups and know all the rules and can raise the big money, they have a huge amount of influence in our elections. And it's the individual who's maybe not, you know, spending a lot of time in politics, doesn't necessarily know even what the, you know, limits are from you know, 1 year to the next. It's their voice that is being effectively silenced, and they suffer a huge imbalance. So I think that going, you know, back to this idea that we can solve some of these problems, which are very real problems, corruption's a huge problem, but the idea that we can solve it through campaign contribution limits, I think is it's been shown that it's not effective. So my view is that there are some good things to say about the bill, but I think the idea is a little bit behind its time.
Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just going to sort of make these the comments about both of them. You know, clearly want us to move forward with legislation, but I guess for me, what I found troubling is the court's, what I would consider too narrow of a definition of corruption, and it really seems much more focused on, you know, corruption in the form of what can happen from financial contributions, but sort of ignores corruption from the view, the public perception sort of part of corruption. And I just found a quote that is from a political strategist that I think really encapsulates sort of what I'm thinking. This is from Stanley Greenberg. He wrote that the nexus of money and power greased by special interest lobbyists and large campaign donations means that the game is rigged and the wealthy and big industries get policies that reinforce their advantage. He quotes voters who say, we don't have a representative government anymore. And I think, you know, in my experience in working for decades now in public policy and in campaigns, that is something I've heard repeatedly from Alaskans, that the money influence is really, you know, from their perception, really corrupting government and the decisions that are made. And just to put that in the context of some economic data, you know, we look at, and folks might remember the statistic that was widely in the news about who could afford a $400 emergency. And this is comes from the Federal Reserve and their SHED, which stands for the Survey of Household Economics and Decision Making. And, you know, more recently things have improved a little bit, but there's still a full third of American families, and this is, you know, nationwide, not just specific to Alaska, that are unable to afford a $400 emergency. And so, you know, when I look at that number compared to the campaign contribution limits that we're considering, you know, it's clear that just to meet the basic needs of some people, you know, these limits are far above what they could ever even consider to be practical in their lives. And so my concern is that, you know, yes, there's the problem with corruption in the VECO scandal kind of concern where, you know, you feel an obligation to make decisions that are partial to some, you know, contributor. But I think also what's missed here is the perception of the public in terms of corruption and their access to their elected officials. And, you know, maybe more present in my life as the representative for a low-income area. But again, this is something I repeatedly hear from folks in terms of their access to their government and the sort of the feeling that those things are just getting farther and farther away from people being in touch with their particular needs, and then in turn the policies being reflective of what you know, sort of middle class or working class and low income Alaskans might leave. So I'll support the graduated limits. I much prefer the lower limits. I much prefer the bill pre amendments with the 50% limit on out of state contributions. But I do want to get these comments on the record because, again, you know, my sort of evaluation of this process and kind of thinking about it and concern is just that it's been too narrowly defined to think of corruption as just the dollars that go directly to a candidate and not taking enough consideration into the overall influence of money in our political process. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate a lot of the comments and the work that's been done on both of these bills. Because we need the legislative record, as been stated before, in what our intent is. And I like a simplistic approach from the people's perspective in giving donations and not limiting their freedom of speech. And I think what we should be talking about with the public is to make sure that they're looking and they're asking the questions, because there's more that goes on in a campaign than just the individual candidate. And I think that's something that's the people are unaware of. And I think that by limiting in the tiered approach is too restrictive and not as functional for the general public, although I appreciate the maker of the bill in wanting to be consistent with the people and with the courts. But something that the courts are very clear on is that we should not be limiting the freedom of speech. So I'm not going to oppose movement of this bill because I believe that this should go before the fuller body for a consideration more than just the conversation that we've had. I think it merits that. And being able to hear from every district of the state, I think, is going to be valuable to this conversation. But feel that overall, representing Alaskans is not restricting their freedom of speech with these campaign contributions.
Thank you, Representative Vance. And with that, I think we're ready to entertain a motion. Representative Clayman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move to report House Bill 245, version 32, LS1299/A, out of committee with individual recommendations and the accompanying fiscal note, and that would be 245 as amended.
Seeing and hearing no objection, House Bill 245 as amended moves from committee. And that takes us to the third and final item on today's agenda as we circulate the paperwork. That's HB 234 from Representative Shoggy. And I think we can get right to it. There are three amendments submitted. I am going to gavel out at 5 o'clock and no later, so we'll take this up hopefully on Thursday to conclude consideration if we hit time. Or when we hit time. And
briefities, real quick.
Briefities. As requested prior to consideration of these amendments, Representative Clayman has two amendments, which we'll hear in reverse order from the drafting numbers. So let's start with Amendment I.8 from Representative Clayman, a.k.a. Amendment Number 1, Representative Clayman.
So I'll move Amendment Number 1, which is version I.8.
I'll object for discussion, Representative Clayman.
So Amendment Number 1 does those three or four things, but in broad perspective, the big impact of Amendment Number 1 is to go from annual limits to campaign period limits. So there'd be a single limit that applies to the entire campaign. And the campaign limits is particularly focused to the concern that the courts have articulated with the ability from challengers to meaningfully run a campaign against an incumbent. And the effect of the annual limits, in my perspective, and I think consistent with what the court's comments have been, is that the annual limits actually give an unfair advantage to incumbents, because we see again and again that incumbents in the state legislative races will start raising money in the odd-numbered years and then essentially double up in the even-numbered years, and it's rare that a challenger gets filed before the even-numbered year. And so for the challenger to be able to compete on a level playing field with the incumbent, the challenger actually needs to have campaign-based limits and not annual limits. That's particularly highlighted in the Anchorage municipal elections, in which, because of the election in April, the organized incumbent will actually have three bites at the apple. They can raise money 2 years before the election, the year before the election, and in the year of the election with the annual limits and an 18-month campaign finance raising limit. So what this amendment would do, as to all those elections, there would be a single contribution limit for the entire 18-month period of raising contributions that precedes the actual election date. So that's a large measure of what this does. The second part that the amendment does is it raises those limits from $1,000 per year to $2,500 for each campaign period as to candidates. That's obviously, it is a bit higher than doubling the $1,000. The other amendment, which is amendment number I-7, actually raises that amount to the federal limit of $5,800 per campaign period. But the focus here as to why it's the campaign period is, I think it is important that regardless of the election on a state level, whether it's mayor, assembly, state representative, state senator, governor, and now the governor combined with the lieutenant governor, we shouldn't be restricting Alaskans' speech through their contributions. That the notion that a House race is less important than a Senate race, that may be true for some, but for the individual donor and how they exercise their speech rights, I don't think that that's a fair distinction to make. And I think we see that in the federal limits that are treated that way, where the House races and the Senate races have the same limits applied on a per election basis. A couple of other things that this amendment does is it treats groups the same as political parties in terms of the contributions, and those contributions are annual of $5,000 annually and not on a campaign period. And what that recognizes is that there are many groups that are organized on an annual level or engaged in different elections, and so even though they're not officially a political party, they kind of walk and talk and look a bit like a political party, and so they're treated the same in terms of their contribution limits of $5,000 per year. There are some provisions, and I think Alpheus Bullard can talk about those a bit more. Part of what is in House Bill 234 is it's kind of these one-off contributions. A well-funded group could give money to a less well-funded group, and then the less well-funded group could give to the candidate. And so part of the derivative contributions is a limit to other groups that might be doing the same thing, that the better funded group is limited on how much they can give to the less well-funded group. And that's part of what was in the original bill, but those limits, again, track the campaign limits. A couple of other changes in the bill. It defines campaign period, which is the period beginning on the date they're eligible to receive campaign funds until the final reporting date. The second thing is the bill changes the date for the inflation adjustment from 2032 to 2031. That appears on page 2, line 18, and it's in the amendment on lines 21 through 23 on page 2. The purpose of that changing the year is that the goal is to actually have when the amount changes, we want it to apply to the full campaign and not have that amount change halfway through a campaign, so that if the changed fundraising limit with inflation adjustment occurred in 2032, that would actually occur in the middle of a fundraising period. And the intent would be to have that adjustment to occur before the fundraising period starts. I recognize that this would really be pretty streamlined for state elections and the November election. It gets a little more complicated when you look at the Anchorage municipal election, but at some point one can't do everything in statute perfectly, and so it would still be, that's the time of inflation adjustment, and referring back to some of the discussion on the prior bill, I actually think the 10-year period for when the inflation adjustment occurs is preferable to a more frequent adjustment, and it's actually aligned with when the redistricting occurs. So the idea is that the major changes in election process would occur during the same year as redistricting. So the fundraising limits would get adjusted for inflation in the same year as the next redistricting would come up, and then those all would be in place for the next 10 years and then another recalculation. So I think that covers all the things that are amendment number two. For ease of analysis, we distributed a handwritten copy from my office earlier today that actually has all the amendments handwritten onto a copy of the I version of the bill. And so at least in my sometimes difficult going from one page to the next and looking at the amendment in different places, if you look at the copy that we distributed with all the handwritten comments, you'll actually see the amendments and where they fit into the House bill in general. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Representative Clemon, for the overview. Representative Eastman.
Thank you. I would, through the chair, like to ask the sponsor what his thoughts are on this amendment.
Representative Shragi.
Through the chair, Representative Eastman. Thanks for the question. So with respect to Representative Clayman's amendment, I'm largely supportive. I appreciate the discussion that we've had over whether to keep an annual limit or go to a campaign cycle-based limit. I think that when it comes to the ability for a challenger to mount an effective campaign, going to a per-campaign limit makes a lot of sense, and it's a compelling argument. I support that change. With respect to the change in date, I don't feel that makes a material difference. My intent was to keep things as simple as possible, both for the ability for legislators to comply, but also for citizens to understand these changes. And so, like Representative Clayman, I support a 10-year period or at least a longer period for adjusting those campaign contribution caps. And whether it's 2031 or 2032, it doesn't make a substantial difference to me. And then finally, well, I'll just leave it there, and if you'd like. Oh, finally, with respect to going from 1,000 to 2,500, I would prefer a slightly lower number, maybe a doubling of it, just because I do know that the citizens of Alaska in the past have advocated for lower limits. At the same time, Representative Eastman, your comments with respect to the changed political landscape and legal landscape more specifically, I think is very compelling. I feel very strongly that independent expenditures, independent expenditure groups have been elevated to a new level in our nation today. And so I think increasing the capacity for individual donors to give to a candidate who, in my view, is much more accountable to those dollars and much more accountable to the voter, it makes a lot of sense. And I very much appreciate the concerns over the appearance of corruption, but I think the courts have been pretty clear that you need to have some compelling evidence if you're going to keep those limits low as to why there's a severe risk of corruption at that level, and I don't know that case has been made, at least to date. So all that is to say, I support the $2,500 limit. We prefer to see it slightly lower, but I'm comfortable with all of the changes presented by Representative Clayman. Thank you.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. Question for the sponsor of the amendment. I like the direction that we're going for as far as campaign period. Now you mentioned that various groups, are organized by year, and so we're still kind of maintaining that idea. But it occurs to me that a lot of those groups are only by year because we've sort of forced them to be by the APOC's calendar year requirements. And that requirement, in the case of some municipal elections, ends up you file to register as a group in January, and then by April, less than 4 months of a cycle there. So I was just curious, would you be opposed to sort of making those group requirements also reflect that campaign period? At least the option to do that, because it would seem to me that there's a lot of support for moving towards that campaign period, and maybe for groups as well.
And through the chair, Representative Eastman, that's actually a topic that we had tremendous debate in my office about the pros and cons. And where it came down was, let's say there were two groups. One was Alaskans against the dividend, and another was Alaskans for the dividend. Well, that interest, although it doesn't get tied into one particular party or the other, that interest tends to carry over from year to year. And because of that, and because they may choose to invest their speech dollars in different campaigns and different candidates based on how they see things, I suppose I see the practical reality is we have a lot of groups that are out there that are organized and are participating regularly. And I think that trying to do that on a campaign level as opposed to an annual level actually increases the administrative burdens for an organization like APOC and actually makes it harder to regulate in the long term rather than easier to regulate. And so I think there's a level at which I think as a legislator, we want the public to be able to have really understand who can do what. And you could have this, I think, kind of strange dynamic in which so Alaskans for Dividends also gets involved in the Anchorage municipal election, and they're raising money one hand for the Anchorage municipal election and on the other hand for the state election, and they're raising money at the same time, and they're saying, well, this is for this pot of money and this is for that pot of money, and then trying to figure out where did the money go and who did it get spent on just gets more and more complicated, whereas they actually are practiced in doing that on political parties, and so treating organized groups like a political party seems to me, from a standpoint of regulation, to be a simpler approach and wouldn't create more and more burdens on APOC.
And with that, I'm going to put a pin in HB 234 as we're at 458, but I think we've got the amendment on the table, and we can take it up off the table at a future hearing, hopefully on Thursday, but stand by. And really appreciate you being here, Representative Shaggy and the amendment, Representative Clayman. We're back Thursday at 3 p.m., and we'll hear that agenda, time allowing. And with that, we're adjourned at 4:59.